This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Except for a few teams, the San Francisco 49ers at 1-7, the Miami Dolphins at 1-8, and three spoil sports at 7-1, the National Football League's members are pretty much following the commissioner's script. Don't win enough to create the impression that you can't be beaten. Don't lose so often that your fans give up before Thanksgiving. It's still called parity. Joining us on the line is Paul Attner, who covers the NFL for the Sporting News. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, that was one of the great definitions of parody I've ever heard.
I better quit copyrighting.
I know. I wish I had written that one. That was great.
All right. Anyway, the last time we talked, you picked the New England Patriots and the Philadelphia Eagles to meet in the Super Bowl, and both teams were undefeated until Pittsburgh came in and knocked them off in successive weeks. Now the Steelers, with the rookie quarterback and a 7-1 record, are the hottest team in the league. Time to change your prediction?
Well, see, you were doing really good to get to that part. You know, I mean, if you just stopped at the Eagles and the Patriots, look how good I would have looked.
Absolutely. One loss.
You know, you always have to add that second part. It's hard not to make a case for the Steelers right now. You could nitpick a little bit and say, well, they won both of them at home and all that, but they dominated both teams so much, Bill, that you just right now they are the best team in the NFL. And that's now. There's a long way to go, and I think that the Patriots probably are the equal of the Steelers, and it'll be interesting if they meet again.
Well, I don't want to stop talking about the Steelers quite yet. They have a 23-year-old quarterback in Ben Roethlisberger. I didn't think somebody that young was able to understand all the vast complexities of an NFL offense playbook.
They're not supposed to, see, and it is ruining all these images of this nuclear science world of the NFL that this young guy could possibly figure out. All these schemes and the devious ways of these defensive coordinators that stay up all night to devise these ways of befuddling the young guy. And, in fact, I just finished talking to the young guy the other day, and he explained a play to me. And I said to him, well, you know, you're not supposed to be able to see all that stuff. And he just looked at me with this look like, well, I know that, but I'm doing it anyway. And I guess that explains it all. He's doing things that young guys don't do in this league, and there have been very few young quarterbacks that have had comparable success, and I think that given more experience, he's even going to be a bigger factor.
Paul, the aforementioned New England Patriots had set a record for number of consecutive wins earlier this season. Then they lost a game, and their most recent triumph is coming back and winning again despite a lot of injuries. Short of kidnapping Coach Bill Belichick, what does anybody else do to beat them?
They have some weaknesses, but having said that, they can get a lot better on offense. I mean, they're not playing as well on offense as they should be, and I think they will be getting better that way. So, you know, they're not going to lose a lot of games this year. They're not unbeatable, obviously, we found that out, but they're also very, very good, and because of that great coaching and the way they play together as a team, I don't foresee them losing, you know, more than maybe one or two more games.
Regarding your other pick, the Eagles, Terrell Owens has made a tremendous impact during his first year in Philadelphia. Has his play on the field more than compensated for what people feel is his, well, let's say this as kindly as we can, distracting behavior off it?
It has, and what's interesting about his play on the field, it has been distracted, I think, in people's minds by the mouthing off and the dancing and having running feuds with seemingly every player in the league and every coach in the league, and even the league office. He doesn't like them much either. But his play on the field, Bill, has been terrific. I mean, he came into Philadelphia knowing he was going to be a difference maker, knowing there was a lot of pressure on him, talked about it, said, hey, I am going to be the difference, and he's lived up to that. I think he's had an MVP season halfway through, and because of him, the Eagles are much better suited to win a Super Bowl, to get to a Super Bowl, than they have been the last 3 years.
The rest of the NFC features a pack of teams that win impressively one week and then have the people who bet on them grinding their teeth the following week. But which out of that lot might challenge Philadelphia over the second half of the season?
Can my answer be D, none of the above? Yeah, I don't know. They kind of remind me of an old-fashioned reference here. They're like Keystone Cops. I mean, they keep kind of running around, stumbling over each other. I mean, I thought Seattle was going to be very good this year, and so far I've not proven to be consistent enough. Green Bay got off to a terrible start. They're playing a lot better now. Maybe they'll emerge. Maybe if Randy Moss gets healthy for the Vikings, they'll be able to resurrect enough wins to make the playoffs. I would say from Green Bay, Seattle, in Minnesota might emerge someone who can challenge the Eagles, who, by the way, you know, don't look as formidable as they did, but right now there's no one to step up to challenge them. You know, they should have, a pretty easy ride to the Super Bowl.
One team that will not be in the playoff hunt this year is Carolina. The surprise representative of the NFC in last year's Super Bowl is currently 1-7. What happened?
Well, I think it's hard to say that you can't use injuries as an excuse here, but you got to. I mean, they just had some of their best players, both on offense and defense, not just get hurt, but be lost for the whole season. And no team in the NFL can overcome a lot of injuries, especially to your best players. And they just lost a lot of good players. And if they get all those guys back next year, which they should, my guess is they'll make a run for the playoffs. But right now, I mean, they're just one or two or three bricks short of a load every time they play on Sunday.
Miami Dolphins head coach Dave Wannstedt resigned this week. I guess the happy side to that story is he doesn't have to watch the Dolphins play anymore.
Given his choice of having to show up for the next eight games, he decided against it. Proving once again what a wise man he is. You know, I think he was done badly. I really do. He was forced to resign. He asked if he was going to be retained next season, and they told him no, that, you know, that he could stay on the rest of this year but wouldn't be brought back. And he took the high road and said, okay, you know, I'm like you said, why put up with watching this nightmare every Sunday? But he didn't deserve this. I mean, he lost his best running back, Ricky Williams, who really was the center point of their offense. Ricky Williams is just a bizarre guy who just walked away from him on the eve of training camp.
And is apparently trying to walk back,
well,
by
yeah,
some accounts.
Yeah, because he doesn't want to lose about $8 million. I mean, you know, he may be dumb, but he doesn't want to be financially poor the rest of his life, I guess. And then David Boss, his best receiver, got hurt too. So, I mean, those are things that Wannstedt didn't control. And he was in the playoffs a couple of years as a coach and won at least 10 games three other times with the Dolphins. And that resume should hold up when you have these stupid things happen to you that you can't control. But obviously the Dolphins believed otherwise.
Paul Attner covers the National Football League for the Sporting News, and he's our Hulks of Harvest Time handicapper. Thanks again, Paul.
Thanks, Bill.
How does a team that's given up the fifth most points per game this season get to the Super Bowl? The answer may be to score the most points with the NFL's most potent offense. At least that's what the Indianapolis Colts are hoping. The Colts got close last year before losing to the New England Patriots in the AFC Championship game. This year, as Ron Schachter reports, Indianapolis is aiming higher, mainly on the strength of its highly regarded and most highly paid quarterback.
The Colts haven't been to the Super Bowl since 1971. In those days, they played in Baltimore under Hall of Fame quarterback Johnny Unitas. They've called Indianapolis home for the past 20 years, and these days they ride the arm of Peyton Manning, who's put up Unitas-like numbers and then some. Manning is easily the NFL's highest-rated and highest-paid quarterback this year. With 26 touchdown passes this season, he's on a collision course with Dan Marino's record of 48. And he'll probably reach 4,000 passing yards for the sixth straight year, another record. Colts coach Tony Dungy is not surprised at Manning's performance.
It's pretty much business as usual. He's very, very much a perfectionist, so he's always looking to improve his game, and he'll start every year with kind of a checklist of things he wants to be better with. And this year he talked about how he wanted to be better in the red zone, a little bit more efficient when we got inside the 20. He wants to throw at 70% completion percentage. He's at about 67 right now. But he always challenges himself every year to try to get a little bit better.
But Manning is simply the main engine driving an offensive juggernaut. The Colts are loaded, starting with running back Edgerrin James, recovered from past knee injuries and headed for another 1,000-yard season. They also have a fleet of talented wide receivers, including Brandon Stokley, who knows that the Colts' offense holds a distinct advantage over the opposition.
I think we just combine so much with our running game and our passing game, it's tough to stop us. We can run the ball in any formation. We can throw the ball in any formation. So it's tough for defenses to plan for us and to stop us, because by doing both things, you really limit the defense to what they can try to take away from you.
The Colts are 5-3 at the season midpoint and share the lead in the AFC South with the Jacksonville Jaguars. But many feel the key to the Colts' season is their defense, which has allowed an average of almost 26 points per contest. In last week's 31-28 triumph over the Minnesota Vikings, Manning's four touchdown passes were barely enough to keep his team in the game. That's been a challenge for Tony Dungy, who's managed a 27-13 record in his 2.5 seasons here, but without the trademark defense of his winning teams in Tampa Bay.
It's a little frustrating for me when we're not playing well defensively and not stopping people as quickly as I think we should. We had a group of defensive backs who got hurt in the preseason, but we've got a young group, and they're going to grow, and I've got to just force myself to be patient, and sometimes that's a little hard.
Still, the Colts are literally banking on their offense to take them all the way. Before this season, they inked Manning to a 7-year, $98 million contract extension, including a $34.5 million signing bonus. Mike Chappell covers the Colts for the Indianapolis Star. He says that the salaries of the team's offensive leaders have left little money with which to recruit premium defenders.
When you've got an offense this loaded, it's going to limit your defense, and that's what's happening here. It's hard to imagine this defense being more than 10, 11, 12, 15th in the league, but if it's that good, it'll be good enough.
It had better be, adds Chappell, who notes that the Indianapolis fans have waited patiently for their first Super Bowl title.
The expectations of Dungy and the team are to be playing the AFC title game somewhere, either New England or here, and having a rematch with the Patriots again, because I think both organizations feel they're the elite teams. Jim Irsay, the owner here, his goal is to win, as he said, not one championship, but multiple championships, and that starts this year.
The Colts host the Houston Texans tomorrow, but a trip through the postseason could include games against the resurgent Pittsburgh Steelers, New York Jets, or defending Super Bowl champion Patriots. And the clock is ticking louder this year because at season's end, the Colts may lose both Edgerrin James and all-pro receiver Marvin Harrison to free agency. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Indianapolis.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. I thought that it might be a good idea, and nobody had done it before. That's how Dirk Guion explained why he'd ridden a skateboard 1,850 miles crossing Australia north to south over a period of 17 days. Nor is Mr. Guion satisfied to rest on his laurels, having demonstrated that he can travel up to 300 kilometers a day on his sail-like, kite-equipped skateboard. Mr. Guion says now that he wants to further modify his board for water travel and, quote, do it all around the world.
So come on, wheels, take me home today. Come on.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a new biography of Wilt Chamberlain reviews his records and remembers him with respect. But first, tomorrow afternoon in Los Angeles, the Kansas City Wizards will play DC United in Major League Soccer's championship game. Joining me now is MLS veteran and current soccer commentator Greg Lallis. Greg, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill. Great to be here.
DC v. KC has a nice ring to it, and an argument can be made that this game pits the league's best offense against the league's stingiest defense, but would it be better for Major League Soccer if L.A. were playing New York, New Jersey tomorrow?
Well, probably from a television standpoint it would, but, I mean, New York's on-the-field display has been pathetic all year, really, mm-hmm. So I don't think you'd really want to watch them. I also think that it's good to have D.C. there because of the whole Freddie Adu mania thing that has swept the country, I think. That's a good one.
As backers of D.C. United are quick to boast, United has won 8 major domestic and international championships. In the revolving door world of MLS, where nobody stays anywhere for very long, how has that one team been so consistently successful?
Well, I think that it actually stems from the top. They've got a general manager, a guy named Kevin Payne, who's been there all along, and there's been a continuity of style and tone, I guess is the best way to put it, starting with Bruce Arena, who was the original coach who won the first two MLS Cups when he was there, every coach that's been there ever since has sort of maintained this, let's go out and play, let's have a great time, let's excite the fans, and they have great fans. And you bring all that in, and it actually sort of feeds itself to maintain a level of play that is always at the highest caliber for D.C.
Kansas City has made it to the final despite losing for large parts of the season. Most of the players casual fans know anything about: Preki, Tony Miola, Chris Klein. In fact, this is what Diego Gutierrez, the KC defender/midfielder, had to say in a press conference earlier this week.
If there's one thing this group hasn't done all year long is worry about what the outsiders and quote-unquote experts think. If we believed everything we read and everything we hear, we would have came in 10th in the league for sure.
How much of the credit for Kansas City's success without stars goes to coach Bob Gansler?
In my mind, I think Bob Gansler is the best coach in the league, arguably the best coach ever in the league. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy's he seems to get his players to do things that they don't even know that they can do. And I don't know why that is. It's part of his experience. Part of it is that he has a system that works, and he just sort of plugs in these interchangeable parts. And, you know, he's actually a really funny guy. He might be the only funny German person in the world. But, you know, he somehow gets everyone to smile while they're doing this work, and it works.
Greg, the predictions that I've seen are split 50-50. Was that by prearrangement to build suspense? And why do you think people who picked D.C. United to win yet another championship are wrong this time around?
I just think that Kansas City plays a nice defensive game with a great counterattack. The people who picked D.C. are sort of mesmerized by all the hype of this team that scores lots of goals, and they're very exciting to watch. And obviously last week's game against New England was one of the best games in MLS history, probably. But the reality is that Kansas City comes in with, in my mind, a better team from top to bottom, starting in the back with Jimmy Conrad and going all the way up to Josh Wolf, who's an international player. And they play with an excitement when they're going forward that is just breathtaking to watch this counterattack that they do. And Bob Gansler will have them totally prepared for this game. I'm saying Kansas City, 2-0. Final score guaranteed.
Greg Lallis is a soccer columnist for MLS.com. He joined me from Los Angeles, the site of Major League Soccer's championship game. Greg, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
Back to Luckwick. In the chamber. He made it. He made it. He made it. The fans are all over the floor. They stopped the game. People are running out on the court. 100 points.
Wilt Chamberlain may have been the greatest player ever to run the floor for an NBA team. Certainly he saw it that way. At the very least, the 7-foot-1-inch Chamberlain was an extraordinary force at both ends of the court. In the new book, Wilt, subtitled Larger Than Life, author Robert Cherry makes the case that Chamberlain's life beyond basketball was also extraordinary. Robert Cherry joins me now from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Mr. Cherry, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
Wilt Chamberlain broke 8 NBA records in his rookie season, 1959. Is it fair to say that no first-year player ever had a more significant impact on a team sport?
Unquestionably, and the NBA encyclopedia refers to his rookie year with the title Never Before and Never Again. He demolished all the scoring and rebounding records. He also showed people, and this was no insignificant point, so as did Bill Russell, that tall men could be athletic. And now we have 7-footers like Kevin Garnett and Dirk Nowitzki who run the court. Well, Wilt was the first agile 7-footer. They also, the NBA, tinkered with the lines so Wilt couldn't poach under the basket. And during his college years, there were many rules changed to minimize Wilt's effectiveness, and many times over the years, Wilt would say they never changed the rules to make it harder for Michael Jordan to play the game, but they did time and time again for Wilt Chamberlain.
Chamberlain's numbers, of course, speak for themselves. He set over 100 NBA records during his career, but folks who never saw him play may not appreciate how strong he was. There's a story in your book about a particular blocked shot. Gus Johnson was the unfortunate shooter that demonstrates Wilt's strength. Tell us that story as former 76ers trainer Al Domenico told it to you.
Al Domenico said it was the most amazing thing he's ever seen on a basketball court, and he's watched basketball games for probably 50 years. Gus Johnson intercepted a pass and was going down to dunk the ball, and Wilt's teammates are on the other side of the court, and he's the only one back. Gus Johnson goes up to jam the ball, all 6'8", 250 pounds of muscle, and Wilt blocks the shot. And normally you'd think that Wilt's hand would move back because of the force of Johnson slamming the ball down, but Wilt's hand did not move. And from Johnson fell to the floor, grabbed his shoulder, and had a dislocated shoulder. They had to take him to the hospital.
Wilt Chamberlain had, of course, a long and productive career in the NBA, leading Philadelphia to one championship and Los Angeles to another. But did your research lead you to the conclusion that he was satisfied with his achievements as a player?
Yes and no. He was satisfied that he set records that will never, ever be approached. Nobody ever approached him except Wilt. It bothered him that some sports writers, and I emphasize some sports writers and some fans, thought of him as a loser. That was the bane of his adult existence. Wilt was considered Superman, even by his fellow players, and people expected him and his teams to win every single game, and nobody wins in a team game without the support of the team. As Leonard Coppett, a sports writer I interviewed for the book, said to me, it's a team game. No one wins a team game as an individual, not Michael Jordan, not Babe Ruth, not Wilt Chamberlain, not Bill Russell. You win as a team, you lose as a team.
When the NBA season was over, Wilt Chamberlain would often play for the Harlem Globetrotters, and you write of that experience, quote, he could, for the first and last time in many years, enjoy playing basketball. Why couldn't he get joy and satisfaction out of playing in the NBA?
For the reason that we've been talking about, everybody expected him to lead his team to the championship, and anything short of that, he was blamed for it. Wilt pointed out the great Bill Russell, his nemesis, played with eight future Hall of Famers, and Wilt had very good players, but his team was not as good as Bill Russell's team, and Wilt Chamberlain was not the reason his team lost. Though Wilt was very sensitive and took it personally, and that's why he loved the Globetrotter experience.
Wilt Chamberlain was often measured against Bill Russell, whose Celtics teams so consistently beat Wilt's Philadelphia teams in the Eastern Conference Finals. Their relationship was complex and uneven, but at one point you write that Wilt criticized Russell because he, quote, intellectualized playing defense and basketball in general. What did Wilt mean by that?
He meant that Russell sometimes talked too much about the esoteric, the angle of the shot and the existential nature of basketball. And Wilt was a little critical of that and said it's more simple than that. You box your man out and you get the rebound. You go up and get it.
Of course, when you're as strong as Wilt Chamberlain was and you could actually break a man's shoulder by blocking his shot, you can afford to think in physical rather than intellectual terms, I suppose.
Well said. And also, Wilt was a contrarian. If you said red, he would say white. If you said this, he would say that. He loved to engage people in discussions, disputations. And, of course, he thought he was the world's expert on everything, and that I refer to that in many places in the book.
Well, you present Wilt Chamberlain as an exceptionally thoughtful and sensitive man. When a crowd of people on a flight with Wilt kept bothering him for autographs and at the same time ignoring the Nobel Prize-winning scientist across the aisle, Wilt said, quote, we have a lot of false heroes in America. Do you suppose on one level he considered himself a false hero?
Yes. He would say, admire an astronaut, admire a scientist, admire a mathematician more than baseball players or football or basketball players who play a child's game and get paid a lot of money to do it. Though at the same time, he was proud of his athletic achievements. But in the larger scheme of things, he would say Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, a scientist who's working on a cure for cancer, or much greater people than me or Bill Russell or Jim Brown or Johnny Unitas or whomever. No disrespect meant to those great athletes.
Why, when it came time for Chamberlain to write the story of his own life, did he mention the fact that he'd made love with 20,000 women, or at least boast of that fact? Was that kind of the boast of a thoughtful, sensitive man?
No, I don't think so, and I think he came to regret it. There was also, we all have our insecurities, and Wilt has had his insecurities, and my take is that he needed to boast about that he was the world's greatest cook or that he was always right on this and that point because people thought of him as a loser, and I think he liked to show people he was well-read, and he was well-read. And in this case, I think he liked to show people not only can I score on the basketball court, but I can score off the basketball court. Friends told me he came to regret the statement because he really became a poster boy for sexual bragging, and that's part of his legacy, along with the great athletic achievements. And I wish I had hair on my head for every person who, during the course of writing and researching this book, asked me, did you meet one of the women, sort of with a snicker. And it's sad that some people think first of Wilt and this boast when there was so much more to the man.
Robert Cherry is the author of Wilt Larger Than Life, published by Triumph Books. He joined me from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Robert, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Each year during the weekend after Halloween, Sussex County in Delaware hosts a unique competition. Jamila Trindle of WHYY in Philadelphia attended last weekend's event, and she has this report.
Spectators stand in a mile-long Delaware cornfield with eyes to the sky. They're waiting for pumpkins to fly. World Championship Pumpkin Chunkin' President Frank Shade explains this annual competition.
We've gone to a full 3 days. Every one of the machines here will shoot one competitive shot each day, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then the longest distance in that class will be claimed the champion of that class. The longest distance of the entire event will be the world champion.
Competitors line up 100 machines to compete for the title of world champion. They're sorted into 15 classes, from human power to compressed air guns. But as Shade explains, even watching the event takes a little practice.
There goes an air cannon there. See the little bit of vapor coming out of the end of that barrel? That's the machine that shot. These pumpkins are coming out as fast as a bullet leaves a handgun or something, you know, so you don't see them leave very easily. And normally another big mistake people make is as soon as they hear that noise and they see that vapor mist at the end of the barrel, that's right where they look, and the pumpkin's already 600 to 800 feet past that.
Shade says when the pumpkin lands, spotters on four-wheelers rush out to locate it and then use laser triangulation to measure the shot.
Their distance was, if you're keeping score, Pumpkinator, 3,343.67 feet, 3,343.67 feet.
Some teams spend all year making adjustments and preparing their machines for this one weekend. Larry McLaughlin is the team captain of the Determinator, a centrifugal force machine.
Basically, we take a paper bag, napkin, whatever we got. We draw up a blueprint. We decide that's what we're going to do and hang on to them napkins for a while. And the month before, we start to go to work on it. Our engineering has baffled MIT. I mean, MIT just can't realize how can we make a pumpkin fly? I mean, but these are backyard engineering.
It's a lot of work, but McLaughlin says the payoff is big.
In 1992, actually, I took the world championship, and basically this is what this is all about. Bragging rights for a year and a little gold ring with a diamond in it.
McLaughlin says the Pumpkin Chunkin' officially started in Delaware in 1986, but the competition isn't unique to the first state. First-time competitor Kerry Smith says he helped build a giant medieval trebuchet to throw pumpkins near his vegetable stand in New Hampshire before he'd ever heard of the competition in Delaware.
At the farm stand, we have a castle that we throw pumpkins at. In 3 years, we have hit the castle twice. when we throw a 200-pound pumpkin and it goes 500 feet, it explodes. I mean, it literally explodes, and it has a big boom and everything, and the people love it.
This competition is limited to pumpkins, but President Frank Shade says that doesn't keep chunkers from experimenting.
We have thrown watermelons. We have thrown cantaloupes. We have thrown toilets. We have thrown... Again, anything you put in a sling, we can make go forward. And it doesn't matter what it is, we'll make it go forward. That's the fun part.
For Only a Game, I'm Jamila Trindle in Millsboro, Delaware.
One, two, three, four, and there it goes.
My pumpkin is smooth and round. Its carved eyes invoke the town. That silly orange thing is a blast. Come on now, do the jack-o'-lantern smash. Jack-o'-lantern smash.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implant, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. And from dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, swimming, paddling, and slogging the length of the Charles River. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's news. Oh, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Former Ohio State running back Maurice Claret claimed this week that he had been less than forthcoming with the NCAA investigators in the past because he wanted to protect Coach Jim Tressel, whom he alleges provided him with a veritable cornucopia of verboten swag, including a car to truck it all the way in. Do these revelations clear Claret's name as he contends they have?
I don't know. I mean, I think confession is good for the soul, but it's not very good for your reputation with the NCAA, unfortunately. We have money. We have boosters. We have loaner cars. We have no-show landscaping jobs. As you said, we have the full cornucopia of amateur athletics here. It's hard to imagine that everyone at Ohio State will survive this. Although we did have a similar story this week down at Memphis State where three basketball players had their apartment broken into and reported that having been stolen were, among other things, $6,000 worth of shoes and $2,500 worth of diamond rings. And Coach John Calipari's answer was essentially, well, that's what you can buy with a Pell Grant these days. People are not getting the message.
No. Is there anything in Claret's charges that we haven't heard before as far as the way football players prosper at universities like Ohio State?
Well, no, and Ohio State is counting for its basic spin control on the fact that Claret has been, you know, open about his ability to be sublet. What he's claiming now, of course, is that he was essentially the fall guy for the school during an NCAA investigation. And what he wants to do is make sure that National Football League owners and general managers who may be up to drafting him will understand that he is actually a stand-up fall guy.
I love it. Terrific phrase. As if to prove that Claret's charges aren't so serious after all, and not only Memphis State this week, but two Michigan State football players were arrested this week for setting off bombs. I wonder how closely the coaches recruiting these guys checked anything but their size and speed.
Well, they obviously have somewhat of an aptitude for chemistry. You know, it doesn't take a lot of brains to, like, egg a frat house or TP the sorority, but it takes a brain to build a bomb. This is actually familiar to me because long ago I wrote a story in GQ magazine about two Washington State players, one of whom died and the other one lost a hand in planting a homemade bomb out in Pullman. One hates to use the word prank because it's far more serious than that, but these are two 19-year-olds being dumb.
Bobby Bowden earned his 350th coaching victory on Thursday when Florida State beat NC State. So the coach is halfway to 700.
He's also halfway to 150 years old. He's doing well. I mean, the obvious comparison is with Joe Paterno, who's hanging on by his fingernails with a really terrible team at Penn State, and it really is time to go. You wonder at this point, of course, how much actual coaching Bobby Bowden does, but he does get propped up on the sidelines the way Bear Bryant did in the latter days. And 350 wins is a lot of wins. That's a career.
Speaking of coaches, Bill Parcells said this week that his 3-5 Dallas Cowboys are exasperating him more than any team he has ever coached. So, can we expect a five-game Cowboys winning streak to commence on Sunday?
Oh, you don't. I mean, when you call your team stupid, it's really you're really pushing all the chips to the middle of the table because there's no plan B. If it doesn't work,
that's right.
What do you do? Go back to them the following week and say, no, no, I was wrong. You're really stupid? But we've seen a little epidemic in the NFL of coaches throwing their teams overboard. Mike March did pretty much the same thing in St. Louis after they lost to New England last week.
Mm-hmm. Ray Bourque, Boston's own, except when he won a Stanley Cup with Colorado, was inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame this week. Were you surprised that he and his fellow inductees weren't locked out of the ceremonies by the league?
Well, the National Hockey League seems to exist now basically as a concept rather than an actual league. I didn't realize you signed your name in a golden book when you joined the National Hockey League Hall of Fame, which is really kind of cool. Paul Coffey, of course, is the heir to, ironically, the Bobby Orr School of defensemen, while Ray Bourque, as Harry Sinnen likes to say, if he had a one-goal lead, he'd want Ray Bourque. If he was one goal behind, he'd want Bobby Orr. Bourque labored in that shadow the whole time he was in Boston. He's a terrific player beyond the longevity. I never saw anybody in Boston actually have a parade when they won the league championship somewhere else. But Ray Bourque was held in such high esteem that they gave him one.
Also honored this week was Minnesota Twins pitcher Johan Santana, who on Thursday won the American League Cy Young Award. Will this be the first of many for the 25-year-old hurler? I mean, he's only beginning to be 42.
Well,
he's got a lot of years to go.
You know, this is a great story. He came all the way back. He's the first Venezuelan to win a Cy Young Award. Apparently, car horns were blaring in Caracas.
Of course.
He was 20-6 with a 2.61. He was almost unhittable in the second half of the season. He was 13-0, in fact, after the All-Star break. This is a great thing. Will he ever do it again? I don't know. I wasn't sold on the guy all year, basically, because he was essentially a kind of semi-injured, earnest journeyman for his whole career. But for 1 year, he was terrific.
Houston Astros pitcher Roger Clemens won a Cy Young Award as well. It must be almost routine for him. It was number 7. If he doesn't retire, what great deal does he work out with the Astros for next season? Something like, I only have to come to the ballpark on days when I'm pitching and everybody else contributes 10% of their wins to me, something like that?
I don't know, but at this point, it's hard to think of too many pitchers in the history of baseball who are better than Roger Clemens. Between the numbers and the hardware, he's got most of them beat.
Is there anybody that you would rather be this week than Scott Boras? As it seems to me as if he's the agent for almost all of the most sought-after free agent players looking to relocate. This is a list that only begins with Carlos Beltran, Adrian Beltre, and Maglio Ordonez.
Well, not just that, but here in Boston, he has both Derek Lowe and Jason Veritek, and he's already shot the moon with Veritek, asking for 5 years, $50 million in a no-trade clause, which I guarantee you he won't get from the Red Sox. It's good to be the king. What can I tell you? But he will have an enormous impact, probably more than any other individual, on who wins what next year.
Indiana Pacers forward Ron Artest said this week.
I love this story.
He said this week that he is on board for the rest of the NBA season. Will music lovers everywhere have to wait until June to hear the vocal stylings of Rapmaster Ronald?
We talk about this a lot, but there are certain problems that Alex Hannum didn't have to deal with, and his star forward complaining that he's too exhausted from touring and producing his album to play basketball is one of them. And I know I'm supposed to be outraged, and I know I'm supposed to say, what about kids today? And I know I'm supposed to tut, 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 but I'm sorry, I find this hilarious. I can't play coach because the A&R guys don't want me to?
There's an intriguing battle going on between New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Cablevision. That's the company that owns, among other things, the Knicks, the Rangers, and Madison Square Garden. What is the nature of this fight, and is there a good guy in it?
Yeah, anybody who doesn't want to build a nutty sports stadium on the west side of Manhattan is a good guy, so I guess you line up with Cablevision. Michael Bloomberg has told Cablevision that they should spend their money on the Knicks and the Rangers and Madison Square Garden rather than spending it on ads criticizing him and this proposed stadium, which is a really terrible idea. It's going to soak the taxpayers of New York, and even worse, it's going to give even more fuel to the various groups of fantasts who want the Olympics there in 2012.
And finally, Mr. NASCAR, a new rule adopted by your favorite fastest-growing sport will enable hard liquor manufacturers to advertise their products right on the race cars. What do you think of that pairing?
Does this matter a damn? I'm serious. How have they managed to draw the line for so many years at beer but not whiskey?
Mm-hmm.
Once again, it's an example that the country is not as red as that county map would make it out to be.
Charlie Pierce, two hands on the wheel and eyes straight ahead, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
My General Lee is the town's best ride. All I need is Daisy Duke by my side.
Yes, old Sheriff Roscoe hasn't got a prayer. When the General Lee flies up in the air, and if we somehow land up in a tree, just call old Cooter up on my CB.
In an unremarkable parking lot off Moody Street in Waltham, Massachusetts, at about 11 o'clock Monday morning, Christopher Swain prepared to go swimming in the Charles River. He pulled on a black wetsuit patched across the belly with duct tape and tugged at his fabric gloves, the fingers of which had been partially shredded. Then he looked upstream at the falls where he'd stepped out of the river the previous afternoon.
I took a look at the falls and then I decided I'd walk around the falls. Most of these man-made structures, it's either perfect hydraulic or it ends on some sharp rocks, so it's not that runnable. Although in the Hudson, some of the stuff's broken down enough that I was able to skid down some of the falls.
Sort of put your hands out in front of you and hope for the best.
Yeah, and don't tell your mom.
The Charles River winds for 80 miles from Hopkinton, where the Boston Marathon begins, to Boston Harbor. There is no record of anyone ever swimming the river's length. Perhaps that's because no previous swimmer has been willing to prepare as Christopher Swain has prepared, not only by swimming laps and by working out at the gym, but by sticking out his arm.
I've been vaccinated, you know, against hepatitis A, hepatitis B, get a tetanus booster, you know, before I jump in. I swab my nostrils with a zinc-based gel before I get going, wear the earplugs, wear the goggles, get someone to hose me off when I get out. But beyond that, yes, I'm in the toxic soup, and I can't see what I'm hitting. And the fear is, yeah, that I rack up on a car refrigerator and get just eviscerated, you know, which could happen.
Nor are numerous pollutants and the rusty remnants of discarded appliances the only things that have interrupted Christopher Swain's progress along the Charles, sometimes plodding across swampland, sometimes paddling on a styrofoam boogie board through just a few inches of gunk-clogged brown water, sometimes actually swimming. Another delay has been the people who've seen him from their backyards or from bridges or from rest areas along the highway and figured he needed to be saved.
Turns out no matter how many agencies you tell, you know, you tell the Coast Guard, the NBC, the State Police, there's always one who gets a call that doesn't know.
And the call would be like, hey, there's a guy out there in a river.
Yeah, I think it's a suicide. I think he fell in. I think he's drowning. That's what happened yesterday. And so I got to meet Waltham Police and Fire. Nice bunch of folks.
Nice enough, it turns out, to allow Christopher Swain to continue down the Charles. And at this particular point in Waltham, the river is deep enough for a little swimming.
No, we'll be kicking for a bit.
Back up in the parking lot, Kristen Mellon, Christopher Swain's mom, the one he wasn't going to tell about the various plunges over the falls, watches her son paddle away from the bank. We'll meet him a couple of miles downriver at a stone bridge next to an auto body shop. There, Mom will have the hydrogen peroxide ready for gargling. Kristen Mellon takes part of the credit for her son's quixotic attempt to let folks know the river is still here, that after various efforts to clean it up, it's still dirty, and that it's worth saving. When Christopher and his sisters were growing up, Kristen tried to teach them about their relationship to nature and their responsibility for it. The lesson has led her son to swim the length of the Hudson River, the length of the Columbia in Oregon, and the length of Lake Champlain.
I didn't know that it was going to become quite so compelling. I thought he was going to do it once, but now it seems to be something that's just become part of his nature. I hope to think that it's like a meditation in a way, or a prayer, that he's hoping that he can be giving something to the river as he's swimming it. Most people would just think that's very odd, but I think that that's part of what he's trying to do.
On the bridge downstream from the parking lot where Christopher's mother, his sister Eliza, and I watched Christopher ease into the Charles, there's nothing to do but wait until one of us spots him bobbing around the bend in the river, which at this point is pretty, if you don't look too carefully. It's dappled with sunlight and populated, at least temporarily, by a small family of curious ducks. The surface of the water is broken by a series of channels over rocks and fallen branches, and, just under the bridge, a channel over a pile of shopping carts, metal grates, and other assorted, potentially hazardous trash. Pretty much on schedule, Christopher comes paddling into sight. His mother and sister head down the slope of the right bank to meet him and ultimately to help him haul some scrap metal out of the water.
Hi, do you care if I throw this in your trash?
No, I don't want it. Put over there.
All right, thanks, man.
Yep.
Since October 12th, when Christopher Swain began this intermittent swim, he has been pausing to pull what junk he can from the Charles. At some points along the way, he's managed to involve members of various communities in the effort. Here, it's just the guy who runs the auto body shop, who regards the swimmer as a nut, but is grateful enough for the river-rusted scrap metal he can sell. Back on dry land for a break and some hot tea, Christopher Swain is not surprised to learn that there are shopping carts beneath the bridge under which he'll soon be swimming. His experience on the Charles has taught him to wonder why that's all there is.
People have a real predilection for chucking bicycles in off bridges. I've found more bicycles than I ever dreamed I would find in one place in the river. But, of course, the worst stuff's the stuff you can't see. You know, if you look at the freshwater fish advisories, it's all lead and PCBs and pesticides, and I can't see that stuff. So that's why they test my liver function. That's why, you know, I'll get my blood serum levels checked for PCBs before and after these swims and all that.
Grim as all that sounds, on this mild November day, Chris can easily conjure up situations much worse, such as the one in Canada, where floating logs battered him, and the only way out would have been to call in a helicopter. He didn't make the call, which I suggested to Chris must mean he stays in great shape.
How is it that some pretty much average guy can do this, can swim, you know, 1,200 miles down the Columbia, it's never been done before, 300 miles down the Hudson, all these things in these terrible conditions, at least what, people's minds anyway. I think the answer is I probably couldn't, except that it's an affair of the heart more than an affair of the sinews.
The heart is a big part of the effort, no doubt, and so is the conscience. Just before slipping back into the Charles, Christopher Swain describes his adventures as a kind of self-defense, and defense not only against the greed, pollution, and apathy that seem so often to overwhelm the common sense that should dictate that we take care of our waterways, but defense against the charge that Christopher Swain is sure would otherwise come from his own children.
I think at the bottom, you know, it's being a dad that does it. You know, I have two daughters now, and, like, I think it's maybe it's selfish, but I want them to know that I tried. They'll know that I was a swimmer, not a great athlete, let's be clear, and not a scientist and not rich either, but they'll know I cared about the water too. So hopefully when they tell me that I wrecked the world, you know, in their teens, like I told my parents shortly before asking for the car keys, right, they'll say, oh yeah, but supposedly you tried to help with some water thing back in the whenever, beginning of the century, I don't know.
So Christopher Swain is swimming and paddling and slogging down the rivers so he'll be able to meet the eyes of his own children. And those aren't the only children he has in mind.
I hope that the day comes when those kids grow up, you know, today's 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds grow up, that, you know, they hear the Standells singing Love That Dirty Water on the radio and they don't get it.
I think you've just given us our music cue.
Christopher Swain arrived in Boston Harbor on schedule at 11 a.m. yesterday. He has not yet decided which dirty water to immerse himself in next. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Al Banks at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or perhaps check out our web feature on swimming and surviving the Charles River, please visit the website onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Kristen Mellon, mother of river swimmer Christopher Swain, who defends her son's rather eccentric endeavor thusly.
Bungee jumping doesn't quite do it for the environment, you know.
Well, that's true, unless you're talking about bungee jumping into a nuclear waste dump. Ah, next reality radio show. What do you think? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.